Good evening. James McKenney here with my Science Hour for November. No, it is December 3rd, 2020. I'll be talking about China going to the moon. I'll be talking about Elon Musk talking about going to Mars. I'll be talking about the Arecibo telescope that fell apart this past week. And that's rather strange because that's after a major accident of, I think it was about a year ago. And you would think that it called into question the structural integrity of that immense facility. And you would think that someone would go out there and possibly check it out. But all three of the main towers holding the dish up failed, and the center hole, this whole just canopy of equipment came crashing down, destroying it completely. So it makes one wonder if somebody wanted that to come tumbling down. It was originally brought online in 1963 and remained the largest telescope in the world, and it's a radio telescope, of course, until China built a bigger one, a different style telescope, more recently. But I'll be talking a bit about that. And there's something funny going on there, because like I said, about probably within a year ago, there was a collapse and there was some damage done, but and I think one of the cables snapped, something like that. But now there's three big support towers. They look like radio towers, and they all snapped right in the middle. And the entire center, the observing head, the what they call the head end electronics that are up on this cable that move around because the dish itself is stationary. So this head end, literally called a head end receiver, moves around and receives the signal, the radio signal, or sends a radio signal into deep space. So what exactly were they doing with this? As the public, we really don't have a whole lot of information about what they did with the Arecibo telescope. I had some friends that actually worked there. I taught with some of the people that worked there. It was managed by Cornell University when I happened to be there, and it was built under National Science Foundation grant, managed by Cornell University, and I don't know more recently who was managing that facility. I don't think Cornell managed it recently, but as far as doing serious science, it was a world premier facility. So that is something that, you know, it's a great loss. It's a facility that should have existed for hundreds of years with proper maintenance. So that calls into question, what are people doing that these towers buckled? And typically when you have towers like that, they don't really support. They just have vertical. They take the force vertically down to the ground. And then you have secondary cables that go off from them that take the tension off the tower. In other words, the tower doesn't have any torque left, right, or whatever. The way it's balanced is the force is directly down in the tower. And so for them to collapse in the middle would indicate that maybe there is something going on with those secondary support cables that go off in the distance, or it's hard to say exactly what happened here, but somebody was not minding the farm. I think that is safe to say, especially after the accident, the so-called accident of about a year ago, and there was a lot of people who called in to question that event as being not due to poor maintenance, but due to somebody trying to neutralize that facility. In other words, somebody did not want somebody reaching out. A couple years ago, this was a very strange situation where there was a series of solar telescopes. Now, these are telescopes that look at the sun, and they have typically solar scientists working at them. And there's probably 120 of these around the world. And they started shutting down mysteriously, one after the other after the other. And there was a strange case of one that was in the United States where the people were just, the police came in, and they were not local police, and they raided the place and just made everybody leave. And some guy texted as he was walking out, was able to get a text out that, hey, we're being forced out of this solar facility and we're not coming back. And the claim was, now these were federal agents that were clearing this facility out, a solar observatory. It was federal agents that were clearing it out, and the local police said, wait a minute, you did not have authority to go in there. And it was based on, they said, some guy in there had pornography on his computer. That's what the claim was. But that would not be a federal offense. That would be under the local supervision of the local police and potentially sheriff in that area. It's not something you would bring in federal agents for and clear this whole place out and then say, well, nobody can come back. So very strange happenings at these events. Now, I don't want people to think, oh, that's because there's some strange object coming into the solar system. No. Something else was going on, and slowly, one by one, they also were shutting down all the weather facilities that produced weather information for the public. Now there's only one or two, and those are very poor information. You'd be lucky to get the temperature correct from any of the weather channels that are out there today, and they were consolidated. A lot of the weather channels that were out there went away, even though they were not that good. And then the access, of course, to the satellite data, the GOES and the other geosynchronous satellite, weather satellites, that all went away. So it looks like somebody is little by little, piece by piece, getting rid of these facilities. And you would think that maybe they would just go in and take it over, but they literally did not want people receiving. Now, that telescope also in Arecibo has the ability to tune in on many different frequencies. So it could look in on, say, what is known as the water frequency. That's an FM band. I think it's 1430 megahertz that is characteristic of water. And so the telescope had the ability to look out and just look for places where there was water. That's an example. The other thing, and there was some very good science done there as far as targeting quasars and targeting radio signaling entities out there in the universe. So there was a lot of good science done at that location. But there was a lot of secret science done there also that we just don't know about. In fact, if you look at the sum total of all of the telescope time there, we really don't know much about it. One particular event was when they were looking at Venus, and this was something that Carl Sagan came out. And remember back in the old Velikovsky days, Sagan used that telescope because all of the Velikovsky drama, you might put it, took place in the 1970s. So the Arecibo telescope was well in use in the 1960s, etc. So it was looking at the moon to get characteristic signaling, and they understood what a cratered planetary object would look like in radio signals because the moon is cratered. And so they looked at Venus. And, of course, it has this tremendous CO2 atmospheric, very dense atmospheric shroud around it, so you can't see the surface of Venus. So they sent the radio signal in from the Arecibo telescope to determine what the surface of Venus looked like, and it was very cratered. So Carl Sagan came back, one of his many great errors in science, which was never corrected or recanted when the real data came in. But he said that because Venus is very cratered, that means it's very old, that means it could not be a new planet, and therefore Velikovsky is wrong. But then, decades later, the Magellan spacecraft went to Venus and mapped Venus, and what it realized is that the surface of Venus was volcanic. So all of these thousands, tens of thousands of craters on Venus were not impact craters like on our moon, but they were volcanic craters. And not only were they volcanic craters, they were active, extremely active, to the point where they would rise up, go off, explode, so to speak, and then sink down into the surface of Venus, which was basically molten. In fact, the Magellan spacecraft, using radio signals also, it completed its complete tour of going around the planet and mapping every square inch of Venus, and they still had some lifetime in the satellite, so they said, well, let's just keep this experiment going and remap some of the area that had already been mapped with the Magellan spacecraft. So what they did is they started remapping Venus, expecting to see the same surface that had been there on the original mapping excursion around Venus. And what they found, it was totally different. Within that short year or so period of time, the entire surface of Venus had changed. And so these, like I say, it would imagine making your oatmeal in the morning. And you are boiling your oatmeal, you boil the water, you put the oatmeal in, and then the oats start to absorb the water. And at the very end, you have this kind of like bloop. A bubble will come up and burst, and then it'll cause the surface of the oatmeal to rise up, and then there'll be a bubble that explodes, and then that all sinks back down in and actually causes a depression where the bubble burst. And then, of course, that rises back up and equalizes, and this process goes on. So it's very much like making your oatmeal in the morning, what the surface of Venus is like, which proves that Venus is an extremely young planet, exactly the opposite of what Carl Sagan said. So, and like I said, never recanted, never changed, and that was happening while Carl Sagan was still alive. But anyway, that was one of the uses of the Arecibo telescope, was to map the surface of Venus and to determine what those surface conditions were like. And the end data was correct, that Venus was highly cratered. It's just that they were not impact craters like on the moon. So that's where Sagan made his leap of faith mistake, and it in fact was due to large numbers of volcanic craters, which, by the way, were changing on a continual basis. Other things that were done with the Arecibo telescope, it was used for signaling sometimes to the remote spacecraft out in a deep space, the Voyager spacecraft, etc. And there was NASA has what they call the Deep Space Network. It's a series of big telescopes that are situated around the world, so they could remain in constant communication with the Voyager and the Pioneer spacecraft that went out in search of the planets. But the Arecibo telescope was sometime used in that effort of deep space. You would just call it science, I guess, would be the correct term. Exploring the planets, sending back photos, all of that amazing, amazing information, most of which came back when I happened to be at Cornell. And the information was in the library there. NASA had its deposition of information. All of the information from NASA was there. There were a lot of NASA scientists there. Carl Sagan was considered a NASA scientist, but they were also employed by Cornell. So they were on staff at Cornell. Most of them did not teach. Most of them, or they might have had graduate students working for them, but as far as classroom time, they didn't teach. They did not teach. Carl Sagan taught. In fact, one of the big draws at Cornell was that kids would go into this massive lecture hall, which I was in when I was there. I was teaching like 400 kids in calculus class in a big auditorium, you could hardly see the kid in the very top row. Gee, you know. But anyway, Carl would teach these sessions of astronomy, and they were highly vied for amongst the student body that you would have taken a course from Carl Sagan, the biggest idiot astronomer on the planet. So anyway, that was one of the claims to fame. And by the way, as a person who went through college at various places myself, on the student side, and also then having taught in places throughout my career, I didn't think that the Cornell undergraduate experience was very good, especially in physics, which was the course I was in, because they, in a lot of the courses, they were having graduate students who could not speak English teaching the courses. So anyway, pretty crazy. But my position there, I was an instructor. And so, you know, I was teaching entry-level physics courses and then entry-level math courses. That's what I was doing when I went to the math department. Anyway, I diverge, I digress, as they say. So other things that happened at the Arecibo Telescope facility is that early in its days, it was used, it was the actual, one of the early directors was a guy named Frank Drake, who's one of his fame points, one of his talking points, was the famous Drake equation. And what that did was a probabilistic equation with a lot of factors. And those factors multiplied together, all of them being less than one. So when you multiply them together, the total product gets smaller and smaller and smaller as you add on more factors. But the idea was that you would estimate the factors such as how many Earth-like solar systems with our sun would there be in the universe, and then in a galaxy, and then you would multiply that by the number of believed number of galaxies. And then you would say, and how many of these planets would be in the life zone? In other words, within a region where water would be liquid, like we have on this planet. And then you would multiply that by the factor of that if an intelligent society developed, it might only last 5,000 years or 10,000 years before it's completely demolished by or wiped out either by natural events or self-destructs or something. Anyway, that's what the Drake equation was. And the idea was to try and make an estimate of the number of advanced civilizations in the universe today at a given time. So anyway, that's I've talked about that particular equation on my show previously, some of the benefits and some of the faults of that equation and the concepts behind it. Because a lot of their scientific assumptions were false. One of the false assumptions was that the solar system would form and that all these planets were there and nothing ever happened to them afterwards, when that's not the case at all. What happens is very frequently things come in from outside the solar system. They discharge the solar capacitor, they become large comets, and they interact with the planets. And a lot of these interactions are not sweet and nice. They are violent. They are very violent. And we know on planet Earth, the human race almost went extinct a number of thousands of years ago. So because of two cometary events that were in our recorded history, one was the Noah event, which previously there was massive numbers of people on planet Earth. Probably more than there are today. And then the population recovered in many thousands of years later was the Venus event, which was a major catastrophic event for planet Earth and its population. But anyway, the Drake equation really had a lot of bad science involved in it. But then there's some other issues, for example, that the human race, one of the assumptions was that these civilizations would evolve and on a planet and that they would live there and that's the only place they could be, whereas it's very clear from the Colburn, at least from some of the work that's been done by, for example, Yvonne Whiteman, from England, when she's working with the Colburn, pointing out that the human race, one of the things they say, which is very interesting, is that they crossed the great void. The human race crossed the great void to come and populate Earth. Now, could that mean an ocean? Could that mean a big lake? Or could that mean that we're really far from the next star system and people came here deliberately to populate planet Earth? There's good indication that Mars was populated before it lost its ocean and atmosphere. So the Drake equation really has some issues with it. If you assume the bad science of standard science, then the Drake equation might make sense to you. But if you understand that, number one, the human race might be a lot older than, a couple of apes running around the jungle 7,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, and that allegedly all of the human race varieties, the big black guy in Africa or the little pygmy in Africa or the little Mayan people in the Americas before the Columbus came and discovered the Americas, or the Vikings, if you really want to know who got here first. But then you have, all of the different races of man evolving in 7,000 years from the cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia. Couldn't possibly be true that somehow man came across the Bering Strait and populated the Americas when there were big populations in the Western Hemisphere long before that land bridge could have been crossed, and then we've had pole shifts. So standard science is way off base, is what I'm saying. Although the concept of the Drake equation is very good. That shows that man is starting to think about things other than himself, which is good. Those were pioneers. That was one of the things the Arecibo telescope was used for, was helping understand some of these factors in the Drake equation. I found it interesting when I was doing a little research here on the Arecibo telescope. If you go to Wikipedia, they don't talk at all about all of the major discoveries. You would think that would be part and parcel or primary in any discussion of a big facility like this, but they don't talk about it at all. They just talk about how it collapsed recently, so that article about the Arecibo radio telescope, is only there recently within like the last day, 2 days or something like that, because this collapse just happened like 2 days ago. The big collapse, the cable that broke, last year, that was another event. But they don't talk at all about the accomplishments of this telescope, which is strange. That's strange. So that's why I'm putting a little bit more time into this. And as I said, I knew people, actually worked with people. I did not myself work at the Arecibo facility, but I worked with people who were at that facility. And so, and good, solid scientists doing good astrophysics work at that facility. But those facilities also are being used by the military, what I call black science or black ops science. Just like, for example, the facility in Haleakala in Hawaii. You have military facilities there that nobody knows what they do. There's no published papers that come out of there. There's no peer-reviewed work that comes out of there. So at any rate, it's just kind of strange. And by the way, there was a James Bond movie filmed at the Arecibo telescope. And I can't remember which one. But, a lot of the James Bond movies had to deal with outer space. The one eccentric rich guy takes over an outer space facility and is going to destroy the world and hold it ransom so he can be the most powerful rich man in the world. Typical James Bond scenario. And, of course, the only guy that can save the world is James Bond. That's the Ian Fleming model of James Bond, but the Arecibo telescope was used in a James Bond movie. So somebody, if you happen to remember which one that is, write in. I'd like to know. Maybe go watch it again. I used to like the old James Bond movies. Everybody did, I think, with the various characters. Who, by the way, I believe the first one of the very first James Bond characters, Sean Connery, recently passed away. And another thing I want to mention about the Arecibo telescope is if you went to spaceweather.com recently, the other day, it would have been maybe yesterday, there was a eulogy about the Arecibo telescope, but oddly enough, it was written by a guy named Tony Phillips. Now, I've had quite a few run-ins with Tony Phillips. He's the joker that, for example, at one American Geophysical Union meeting, I was presenting, and I had a big stack of my posters that were printed up. In fact, you can get, I believe, a very similar poster, similar to the one that I have, my 30th anniversary poster that's available on my webpage. It's very similar to that one. But at any rate, I had the posters. You have to understand, when you give a poster session, you have this great big poster, and then you present, and you have a position in the auditorium where the people come around and then you talk to them also during the whole event that might last a week, etc. So anyway, I had small copies of this printed up, 8.5 by 11, and I had them in the newsroom. Tony Phillips kept taking my poster, the ones that were written up for the news media, and throwing them in the garbage. So anyway, yeah, Tony and me are not the best of friends, but Tony is a guy. He's an astronomer. I don't know if he worked at Cornell. He worked at the Arecibo telescope while Cornell was managing it. But anyway, he became basically the filter for everything NASA. And so if you go to any of the NASA news releases, you will see Tony Phillips' name on it. And his job is to control anything that comes out of NASA. Any kind of information, any type of press relief goes through Tony Phillips. He's the final filter. And then it has to be homogenized, blended, pasteurized for your consumption. That's Tony Phillips. Anyway, oddly enough, he's the one that announces the demise of the Arecibo telescope. And so they're a little bit fishy. I've always suspected, of course, I don't know for sure, but certainly because of his position in NASA and because NASA was taken over by the CIA in 1991, that Tony is a well-handled person, let's put it that way. He might think he's somehow an independent person, but at least he has a handler. At best, he's part of the CIA disinformation crew. So anyway, Tony Phillips, had to mention that, give him an honorable mention here. One of the biggest jerks in the science industry. And it's an industry. It's a for-pay, play-for-pay industry is what it is. Okay, so quick marching on here. I want to talk about the China. It's the Chang'e 5. It's a lander that just landed on the moon a couple days ago. I think it was December 1st. So that would have put it, Tuesday, I believe. It landed on the moon in an area. It's like a mountain inside of a crater. So anyway, they're going to take a couple samples of the lunar surface, and they did a successful touchdown. And so China, remember, landed on the far side of the moon about a year ago and had a little rover that drove around, took some pictures. But this one landed. And here's one of the things that's very, very interesting. Remember the Apollo landing scenes, and you can see the out the little triangle window where, the first guy on the moon, Neil Armstrong, the alleged first guy on the moon, there's a little triangle window, and you can see the camera, and you can see the dust flying as the retro rocket is as they're approaching the lunar surface. This is on the Apollo mission. What was it, Apollo 11 or something, that was the first one to actually land on the moon. And So anyway, you see all this dust blowing out from the being jettisoned as the retro rocket is blasting and slowing the spacecraft down, and then it lands on the moon. And then when you get the far away shot of, you know, one small step for mankind, whatever that was he said, one giant leap for man, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, I think is what he said on the stage down in the warehouse in Arizona where it was all filmed. But anyway, remember, they forgot to, in the actual studio version, which is what you saw, they forgot that there should be striated lines going outwards radially from where that engine came down. What's interesting is on the Chinese one, you can see the striated, it's kind of like, well, you can see where the, and also when you're dropping down and this thing is landing, you can see the dust blowing out in all directions radially from where the central retro rocket is. And then after the fact, you can see the striated, what's left over when all of that fine surface dust is blown out of the way. And you do not see that on the Apollo landing. And that was one of the thousands of criticisms of the photography of the Apollo landing, is there was, where's the, you know, with that, you know, and NASA went through contortions to try and explain why there weren't, because their photography didn't show it. But on the Chinese landing right now, definitely was there. And the Apollo lander was much bigger. The retro rocket was much bigger, you know, with much more gas, hot gas coming out and blowing it out in the radial direction. And you could see that radial dust in the Apollo landing footage, but then when you backed away and saw it, there was no trace of that. In the Chinese Chang'e 5 lander, you definitely did see that. And so anyway, they're going to go down, they're going to dig down an entire 6 feet, 2 meters, 6.5 feet or whatever it is, 2 meters, they're going down. And then they're going to bring alleged 44 kilograms of, or no, no, I'm sorry, 4 kilograms of lunar material back. And then that will land in this Mongolian high desert. And then they will be able to examine this lunar surface. And 6 feet down, let me tell you, is nothing. If this lunar body has been out there for any time at all, then 6 feet on the surface is nothing, has nothing to do with the moon. It's all stuff that came in from outside. And this is, you know, whether you believe in the Apollo moon rocks or not or whatever, it doesn't matter. Let's play devil's advocate and say they did bring back some, because the Russians definitely brought back moon rocks. They did not have a manned mission. So it's not a big deal, obviously, to bring back moon material in a spacecraft and bring it back to Earth. Clearly, the Chinese vehicle has some hurdles to overcome. Getting back up into orbit, connecting with the orbiting parent ship, and then coming back home, and then coming through at high velocity, braking, aerobraking, and coming through the atmosphere, and then a parachute landing on the Mongolian desert. Those are some big orders, yeah. So this thing is not home. Remember that the American, it was a flight satellite to a comet. And I believe it was the same one as the Deep Impact. And it went on to go through the tail of a comet. And I think it was called Stardust. Anyway, they had these big foam, kind of like gel nets that they put out as they went through the tail of a comet, and they trapped all this cometary tail material, and they brought it back. And this vehicle was kind of like a mini flying saucer is what it looked like, but the parachutes didn't open, and this baby crashed in the middle of the desert somewhere out in Arizona, as far as I remember, Nevada, somewhere out there. And they went out and picked it up, and it was all smashed, so it had all of this material from a tail of a comet. And lo and behold, there were viruses in the, I wouldn't say viruses, but there were molecules, big molecules that were built up from nucleotides. And that's what a virus is. So there were literally, you could call them, that's what a virus is. It's an organic, not only organic, it's components of DNA. So it's the nucleotides and built up into a structure. And the reason viruses can reproduce is they, they're part of DNA. And so they come into the cells. I'm not going to go through all of that. But anyway, the United States brought this material back, and it broke open in the middle of the desert. So who knows, there's a, actually, what was the name of that movie back in the 60s? It was a story about the space program going out and coming back and bringing back stuff from outer space. And then it was contained a virus, the Gemini strain or something like that, the something strain, the da-da-da strain, Gemini strain, something like that. Anyway, it was a movie, and it was then this virus came back from outer space, and nobody had any resistance to it, and everybody died. It was the Andromeda strain, There we go. Boy, that means, I just thought of that out of the spur of the moment. That means my brain is still working a little bit. To reach back and pick out those kind of fun facts out of the past. The Andromeda Strain movie was about that, bringing back a virus from outer space, and these scientists, crazy scientists. And by the way, NASA has polluted every place it's gone to, the moon, Mars, other planets where they've landed, potentially Titan of moon of Saturn, and other places where they had very poor, if any, sterilization of the spacecraft before it went out and landed someplace. Okay. But anyway, going back to the Chinese lander, 6 feet of surface material from the moon has zero, nada, zip, nothing to do with the moon itself. So the people will go, yes, it'll help us explain the origin of the solar system and maybe where man came from. these people are just blowing smoke. And at your expense, by the way. Okay, but I always like to mention that the unsung heroes in the space program are the engineers who build this stuff. And everybody thinks, oh, Carl Sagan designed the spacecraft. No, Carl Sagan was a guy who got famous because he happened to be the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell when all this was going on. And he went and took the charge up against Velikovsky and became famous and then got the role as spokesperson for the Cosmos series so they could spout off all of the atheist, incorrect Tier 2 science to feed it to you people. On to the next topic. Elon Musk is making an announcement that they are planning to go to Mars as early as 2024. I don't know what these people are smoking out there in California, but to imagine that somebody is going to go to Mars in, it's right now we're heading into 2021. So they're talking 3 years. Max, maybe 2.5 years. They're thinking that they're going to send somebody to Mars. Now, let me make it very clear. They're building a spacecraft. It's really just in the test stage right now, and the engines, the rocket engines, etc., are in the test stage. And they've never gone to Mars without people. They've never gone to Mars with any kind of robotic to test it out, to test the landing. They've never gone to the moon. Elon Musk, you can bicker about the Apollo program back and forth, but Elon Musk very clearly has never gone to the moon, which is much easier than going to Mars. And I've explained this on the show before, that when you go to Mars, there's a window because Mars is not in orbit around us. Mars is in its own orbit around the sun. And it's about 700 and some day window that you have just a few days where you can launch because Mars is, Earth is coming around faster in its orbit, angular velocity is faster, and so therefore there's a window where you can launch and then get out to Mars, because it's on the same side of the sun, basically, if you want to make it very simple. But the next time that Mars is going to be in a position where you can come back is going to be a good 2.5 years later. So now, they've never tested this. They've never had people in space for more than a number of months at a time. We're counting maybe a year at the International Space Station. That gets supplied regularly from Earth. You send somebody out to Mars for, it's going to be a journey of about probably 6 to 9 months to get to Mars. Then when you get there, you're going to have to land. You're going to have to take all the fuel with you to take off of Mars again, plus all the fuel you're going to eat. During that time, the food that you're going to eat, all the water, etc., because there's no water on Mars, boys and girls. And they've never done any of this. It's like when you're a Boy Scout, go back to Cub Scouts, you know, the very first stage, or Girl Scouts, whatever, and you go on your first camping trip. You know, you don't go to Mount Everest and climb Mount Everest on your first camping trip. Probably wouldn't be a good idea. That would be a lot easier than what Musk is talking about here. They have no plan for space radiation. They don't have any plan on how they can get through the radiation belts. Musk has never gone in space out of low Earth orbit in his SpaceX career, nor has he anybody else. NASA hasn't. NASA allegedly went to the moon in the late 1960s and the early 70s for a period of time, but they cannot explain to you how they got through the Van Allen belts. And they say, oh, they found a crack in it, and they went through the crack. Let me tell you something. The Van Allen belts change hourly. They change position, they change dimension, they change energy levels. Everything about them is constantly changing. And NASA had very specific windows where it had to launch because of just the logistics of getting to the moon and coming back. And so they didn't even have information about the Van Allen belts. They had the radiation badges that the astronauts wore were alpha and beta particles only. They did not have X-ray detectors. They didn't have gamma ray detectors. And the real radiation is X-ray radiation. That's what kills the people. And the Russians tried to send men to the moon in the 1960s, long before NASA ever thought about making the final launch to the moon. And those people came back very dead, and the Russian scientists told me that personally. And so they, you know, whenever you bring up NASA going to the moon, they just laughed about it. And I asked them, I said, well, why didn't you bring this up? And they said, well, in the Western press, who's going to believe a Russian scientist back in the Cold War days? They're going to just say, oh, you're just saying that because you want to win the Cold War and deny NASA its fame. Anyway, you know, the whole issue of the Van Allen belts, but it's a real issue. But be that as it may, whether you believe Apollo went to the moon or not, the radiation issue is real, and NASA has internal studies trying to figure out how to deal with the radiation belts. Anyway, so I just find that strikingly bizarre that they just keep pushing this. And from what I understand, they've actually already sold tickets. Or was that a ticket for this rich Japanese guy to go to the moon? I don't know. But 2024 to go to Mars, I think they're pushing it. You just don't go off and stick a person on a spacecraft for the first time. So that would mean, since it's a 2.5 year turnaround, plus the travel time to get there, plus the travel time to come back, we're talking, you know, a plan where you don't send people, you just send sensors, etc., of at least 4 years. That's after you build the spacecraft and properly supply it. And then you would have to have this spacecraft a lot of it autonomous, because you're not going to be getting signals from Earth. Then you have to survive these tremendous dust storms. You know, in the course, you got the Matt Damon feel-good movie where they're saved at the end. NASA goes out and saves them, and, you know, all kinds of difficulties were at the very last minute. You know, I watched it. It was a good movie. not reality, where he's growing his potatoes and he has to ration them. Oh, my goodness. No, that's not going to happen. That's a Hollywood movie. And so to imagine that somebody's even saying that they're going to go to Mars in 3 years, I saw a panel one time, and these women were there, and they were, I think they were scientists at NASA and various, I don't know, capacity, going shopping. You know, they were going to just take their little backpacks and go to Mars. And they were just like going to have the greatest time there. I mean, what are these people thinking? What on earth are these people thinking? Okay, so anyway, jumping back just a second to that China story landing on the moon. Now, they landed on the far side of the moon, a first astronomical or space first landing on the far side of the moon and looking at it, and the thing lands and it drives off into the sunset. And when I saw that, I said, you know, that looks like a studio. That looks like a studio. And when I saw this also, I said, this looks like a studio. And here's another issue. I talked about this before in my show, that this past year, there was an X Prize given to first person private company to land on the moon. So there was a company from Israel, and it was just about to land on the moon. And the vehicle was retro rocketing. It was going down. It was on its way down. And at a critical point, it lost communications. And at the same time, there were a number of other malfunctions that had nothing to do with communications, because this thing is autonomous. Once it's at that point, it's on its way down. It's using sensors. It's using altitude sensors and other onboard equipment to guide, but it lost communication. But oddly enough, that communication was coming from NASA. They were utilizing NASA as a second source because they didn't have the ability to do their own communications. And so this would have been the first time an independent non-country entity would have landed on the moon. And it's my conjecture that the moon's surface looks totally different, that this nice smooth surface with a little, you know, quarter-inch coating of dust is not what the lunar surface looks like. So that's what they made up for the Apollo mission. That's what they made up for the Chinese missions. And the real lunar surface looks totally different. In fact, if you've ever been to a volcanic region, which the moon is, it's all surfaces, you know, volcanic at some point in time. And then there were no plate tectonics to move around. There were no oceans. There's no atmosphere, etc. So it should be looking just like its original lunar surface of volcanic rock. And on Earth, that volcanic rock, through rain and erosion and atmosphere and other chemical processes, breaks down over time into kind of a orange dirt, kind of almost like clay. But you don't have those processes on the moon, so the moon's surface should be like the original volcanic flows that some of them, there's the AHA flow, if you see on Earth, they're kind of smooth, but they're very typically lava. There's the blue lava, which is older lava, very hard. And then there's the fresh lava, which is all over the place. It's up and down and jagged and sharp, and you can't walk on it. That's what real lava looks like. So I don't think that we have seen the real lunar surface yet in any of the American or whatever other samples. And the Russians don't give out information. They have been very cards to the chest type of scientific endeavors regarding the moon. But and the Russians, like I said before, it went to the moon, and it was just to orbit the moon. It was not to land on the moon. It was just to send guys around the moon and come back. And they came back very dead from X-ray radiation. And so, anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there because there's still something very much amiss with this image that we're getting of the moon, this nice smooth surface with some dippity-doos here and there in a quarter inch of perfectly laid dust. Excuse me, boys and girls, but I don't think that's what the moon's surface looks like. And I don't have a spacecraft to go there and prove that. But like I said, the one spacecraft that was independent that was going to go there failed to land. It was in its retro rocketing. It was going down. It was within minutes. And they did. I thought it was a very good idea. They gave him the $1 million or whatever it was, X Prize, for, you know, A for effort type of thing. And then those people can use that money to go back to fund, because all of these things are privately funded. When I won an X Prize, I funded that myself, and with some help from my friends, you might say. But that's all privately funded. You know, you don't get a grant or something to spend your to develop a product for the X Prize. And that was a good year and a half, close to 2 years of my life dedicated to that, with the wing generator and the atmospheric water generators, and a lot of work. But it was, you know, it was really excellent because it gave me timelines and it gave me international exposure, two major things that had to happen. And it was really difficult, not to mention that I did it, there were two hurricanes, there was a live volcano going on where I was at, there were two hurricanes and a major earthquake. So not to throw a little bit of diversity into the whole equation. And then coming up winning in the end the Technology Innovation Achievement Award from XPRIZE, entering a very elite group of people. So X Prizes are very difficult when you get up to the top. In my group, the Water Abundance X Prize, there were 98 teams. So, I mean, these were international corporations, etc. There were some individuals also, but mainly corporations. So to come out on top of that is quite a feat. And like I say, with two hurricanes back-to-back, major earthquake and a volcano going off, that literally shut down the whole area, including the sports and the sea travel, which I was critically dependent on. Anyway, enough of that. So the idea that Elon Musk is going to Mars, nah, ain't going to happen, boys and girls. And to send people out there into that radiation environment without having any knowledge of that would be catastrophic. That's the only thing I can say. Just a quick note on the mathematics of voter fraud. It is unquestionable that there was massive voter fraud in the 2020 election, not only at the presidential level, but at the local and state levels also. And in spite of that, there was a lot of movement towards the new GOP, the new Republican Party, the new candidates who people went out and voted for en masse. Because the Dominion voting machine cheating and the mail-in votes mainly were done just for Biden. They were Biden-only votes. They were produced by machines, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. And also the mail-in votes that were cheating votes were only for Biden. So they didn't do the down ticket. They didn't have time. So that left the actual Republican candidates picking up a lot of wins, although there was a lot of cheating done at the local level. So anyway, I'm not going to say a lot about that. That's still an ongoing process. Okay, next topic, vaccines. Britain is being force-vaccined right now. And those people, this is the beginning of the New World Order beast, the mark of the beast that's in the shot. You will be marked. You will be branded. And once you have this, you cannot undo it. It is going to change your DNA. A lot of people are going to step up in line like, oh, just, you know, they want the shot. Everything's going to be better. They have been programmed. through fake news, on and on and on. In fact, this is biblical in nature, no doubt about it. But the Bible is very clear also. It says very, very few people will resist taking the mark of the beast. Those people will be very few, and those will be the basically like a remnant of the human race. This, in make no mistake about it, is altering DNA. This is going to change the human race for a very long period of time. So, and you know, I don't believe in quoting the Bible for you know, I don't believe in, say, quoting it as a backbone to my argument. This is in your face going on right now, and the United States is next. Australia is already there, etc. So this is on the way. You'll have to make your own decisions as to what you will do. So just they're using intimidation and fear. That's all I'm going to say. I have a few minutes left. I'm going to talk about the sales that are going on my webpage. Literally everything has been marked down. The books, the CD, DVD, the library packages have been marked down by 35%. The education packages have been marked down by 25%. The water filters have been marked down by as much as 40%. Some of the different items, you'll have to go there. The whole house water filters also on sale. And I want to specifically mention arsenic. I'm going to be posting a map on my page of the United States showing all of the high-density arsenic zones where this is in the groundwater. So your city well, your city water, if you have a private well, this is in the water in a high percentage. And if you're showering in that, it's getting through your skin, you're breathing in the vapors. It's a poison. It's a deadly poison. It's cumulative, and you got to get that out of your water at the whole house level. So my whole house water filters are on sale, and many areas of the United States have arsenic problems. Also, the wing generators are there. Those will not be on sale. People are writing in, and I can usually work a good deal for people once we understand what you're going to need. The multi-blade systems are there. There's so many varieties there that you have to fill out the questionnaire on the homepage for me to understand what you really need. Also, the LP and the diesel generators are there. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Do your Christmas shopping there. We will send, if you order two or three things and you want them sent to different directions, different addresses, we will send them. And we'll bear the shipping on this end so we don't have to ship to you and then you ship to your loved ones. And also the grow towers. The grow towers are there, amazing products. Those are selling. People want those where they can grow vegetables in their own house and also commercial systems. I have commercial and home grade on all of my products. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's jmccsci.com. And we are at the crossroads. Good night.